will share. You take that. And we'll share this one. Is that okay?
Yeah.
I probably will say the least.
Oh, I think that's not true.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Questions. Mostly judge for fresh jars and plates on yourself. We're ready to end this one. We're end to end, ladies. Well, we do have, registered people and registered people coming, but focus on one or the other.
Everybody ready? Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Rights Protection Mechanisms User Feedback Session. Our topic is rights protection with a particular focus on what the user experience has been with the new rights protection mechanisms that were built for the new GTLD program. So if you've been to some of the sessions this week, you know that we're gearing up to do a number of review activities relating to the goals of the new GTLD program and what the impact has been. And one of those areas of focus is around rights protection. And so we have, on my team, been compiling a lot of information, a lot of data and numbers, a lot of looking at all of the customer service type questions and issues that we receive, talking to our service providers about what kinds of issues that they see, and looking at a number of different sources. And we realized that what we were missing in this is hearing from the people who are actually, have hands-on experience with using these processes. So we wanted to make sure to account for that. And that is what this session is designed to gather, to start that conversation. So this is how we've structured the time. I'll talk a little bit about the background on the RPMs, and then we'll have a panel and interactive discussion. We're going to try to at least touch on the four topics you see there, the trademark clearinghouse and the verification of rights data, the sunrise period that's required in all new GTLDs, the trademark claim service also required, and the uniform rapid suspension system. So what I'll do here is introduce these subjects and pose a number of questions, which I'll ask the panelists to respond to, and also anyone here from the floor who has wishes to speak to that topic. If you do want to speak to one of the questions on these topics, we suggest that you do it during that topic area rather than waiting to the end, because we are going to try to cover a lot of ground, and we want to allow time there a little bit of time for wrap up at the end. Oops. Okay, so introductions here. I have some colleagues to help with this discussion. Going from the right of the table is Susan Payne from Validaeus, Staten Hammock from Right Side, Anthony Beltran from 101 Domain, Antonietta Mangiacati from ICANN, Vicky Follens from Deloitte, and Aliza Agopian at the end is with ICANN doing remote participation. So all of these people bring different perspectives, and they've kindly agreed to share those with us today. So just to review what the rights protection mechanisms are that we're talking about, they are listed across the screen here. Sunrise and trademark claims, new requirements that are supported by the Trademark Clearinghouse. The URS, which is a complement to the UDRP, which has been an existing form of rights protection for many years. And then finally, the post-delegation dispute resolution procedure on the right. So all of these work together. They perform sort of different functions. Sunrise and claims are really focused on TLD launch and startup processes. URS is geared towards complaints about infringement for specific names, and the PDDRP is designed to address patterns of activity if there's patterns of infringement happening in a registry. One note on the last item, we're not actually planning on talking about the PDDRP today, simply because there hasn't been a complaint filed with that so far, so there's not really a user experience to speak of. So I just, before we get into the topics, wanted to give you a few data points on where we are with each of these things. The Trademark Clearinghouse opened in March 2013 for submission of trademark data, and that was it was open by design early so that rights holders would have an opportunity to put their marks in advance of any new TLDs launching. So you can see the trend there starting from when the clearinghouse was opened up to today. Looking at sunrise periods, there's been over 200 completed, about 35 that are in process right now. The sunrise, looking at the total registrations that have been reported to us, are somewhat on the small side, according to what some people might have expected or predicted. The highest that's been reported to us currently is 713. And from the set of TLDs that we looked at where we had complete data, which was 228, the average was around 118 registrations in a sunrise. Looking at the claims period, over 100 of those have been completed. Close to 100 are going on right now. You can see there have been a lot of claims notices sent, meaning displayed to a potential registrant. That claims notice says, FYI, this name matches something that's been recorded in the clearinghouse. Do you wish to proceed? So high numbers there. Cumulative claims transactions, the second number of 60,000, is the number of registrations that proceeded once the notice was shown. So for something to be a claims transaction, it's reported to ICANN as a name that was subject to claims and where the registrant did proceed to register it after acknowledging the claims notice. Looking at within the 90-day claims period, approximately how many claims transactions occur, it's close to 300. And finally, the URS, so this is kind of an estimate. We're still kind of trying to piece together the different sources of data we had here, but the goals of the URS were to be faster and cheaper than the UDRP. So we tried to do a comparison. We think there have been around 145 cases so far. We tried to do a comparison of what that amount of URS cases, how long they would have taken had they gone through the full UDRP process and be subject to those same fees. So that's kind of just to give you an idea. We assumed for this purpose the maximum fee and that it was a single domain name, a single panelist in the UDRP, although many cases there are more domain names and or three panelists. So that should give you an idea of what is happening there. And with that, I will go into the agenda and to our discussion. So for each item, as I mentioned, we are in the process of gathering all this data and doing some analysis on how each of these things are working. I'm going to ask Antonietta, who's doing a lot of this work, to real quick summarize for you what are the topics that we are looking at and that we've accounted for currently. Antonietta?
Thank you, Karen. So as was mentioned earlier, we're in the process of conducting an initial analysis and review on rights protection mechanisms by collecting and analyzing several quantitative and qualitative data. Some of the topics we'll be looking at include the trademark verification process, which is the first step toward trademark inclusion in the clearinghouse, where if you know the basic requirements are met, the mark is eligible for inclusion, will receive access to the claims service. We will also look at the trademark clearinghouse guidelines and how effective they were in informing the trademark holder and the trademark agents on the eligibility requirements for trademark inclusion in the clearinghouse, as well as the Sunrise and Claim services. We will also look at the topic of proof of use, which is a requirement for rights holders to qualify for participation in the Sunrise domain name registration process. We will analyze Sunrise activity data to determine, for instance, how many rights holders opted to take advantage of the Sunrise period. We will also touch on the topic of misuse of data and privacy concerns from rights holders related to aggregation of mark data through the clearinghouse. We will also look at the matching rules, which you know, is a service whereby domain names associated with a particular record are generated according to a particular set of rules and how effective this was. And we'll be also looking at the different outreach and communication activities, such as webinars, Q&As, events, to determine whether enough awareness was generated to achieve the desired informed public understanding of the clearinghouse and the new GTLD program.
Thank you, Antonella. So let's go into the questions. First, the first piece of this discussion about the trademark clearinghouse is really focused around the process of actually submitting marks to the clearinghouse and having them verified. So most of the questions are geared toward the rights holder perspective. So some of the questions posed here, what was your experience submitting marks to the clearinghouse? What were the challenges, if any? Any suggestions for processes or features that you'd like to see implemented? The last point, as Antonietta touched on, there were in developing the clearinghouse, there was some discussion about concerns about the aggregation of a lot of trademark data in one place. So one of the questions we wanted to pose was whether there had been any issues relating to misuse of that data. And then lastly, as we have Vicki here from the Trademark Clearinghouse, who fields a lot of the questions from rights holders on the clearinghouse and how it works and what the purposes are, I'll also ask her to speak in terms of what you heard from rights holders about these processes. So again, I'm going to pose this question to the panel. If you'd also like to comment on the clearinghouse or the verification process, please do come up to the mic. Anybody want to speak to this?
Hi, this is Susan Payne. Just at the outset, I wanted to make it clear that I'm here on behalf of the intellectual property constituency and its members, which obviously represent intellectual property interests. The membership of the IPC is various IP organisations and brand owners and lawyers and so on operating, dealing with intellectual property law. In answering the first question, about the experience in submitting marks. I'd say generally rights holders themselves probably didn't do this themselves. Generally speaking, they would have been dealing through agents or law firms or registrars. So comments from those probably vary. I mean, I would say generally the submission process was probably fairly straightforward once the kind of technical stuff was in place. But there were some challenges that various of the IPC members did identify. Including things around challenges in validation. So, for example, sort of things like the data fields sometimes had a word limit, so that could be problematic if you had quite a lengthy registration. The TMCH certainly had some difficulties in validating records from some countries. For example, if there was Chinese script, if you had a trademark registration, which was an international registration through the Madrid system, and the individual countries didn't issue a trademark certificate, then some people had difficulties, therefore, in using those marks if there was any kind of geographical requirement for the registration that they were trying to record. Also, issues around things like, you know, marks aren't necessarily static. You might have changes of address or changes of details of the owner, and the TMCH couldn't always really accommodate that very well. So, for example, if you changed the address, even if you've filed and completely updated the trademark office, it would lead to false notifications during the validation process because the TMCH didn't necessarily look to the underlying records or maybe couldn't look to the underlying records. So there were those. There were also sort of issues around some rights holders, particularly large corporates, had some difficulties in actually signing up to the TMCH contract. There were some provisions in there. I can't go into details particularly, but, you know, that were quite difficult for some corporates to get internal sign-off on. And that can be quite problematic. You know, companies don't necessarily like signing contracts that they haven't had any ability to negotiate and where the terms are not ones that they would normally sign up to. Also, some difficulties around things like fee payment. The full fee was payable if the application was rejected. So on some kind of sort of difficult proof of use cases, you know, that caused sort of difficulties for some applicants. So yes, a lot of challenges. I don't know if anyone else wants to talk to that first before I say anything else.
This is Anthony from 101 Domain. As a registrar, and we're a clearinghouse agent as well, we were one of the first ones to sign up for the TMCH. And, you know, as far as the process for rights holders, it was a completely new concept to a lot of them. We have a lot of corporate clients. We do a lot of consulting type sales and strategy with them, and many times we're not speaking with the decision makers. So when they have to go back internally, as Susan was saying, the sign-off and the green light tends to take quite a bit of time. So we found ourselves having to educate the clients quite a bit, finding the correct trademark that they want to use if they're trademarked in multiple countries, and, you know, changes in address and things like that were also difficult. The majority of our clients did go directly with us. We did have some go directly to the TMCH. Some of the issues that they've experienced there, funny enough, is, you know, trying to download the actual file. We get clients sending multiple formats of the file to us. They're not really clear on what they're doing. So to the extent going forward, if there's an easier way to deliver that file, maybe through email or a download link, things like that, would make the process easier for a lot of customers.
Thanks, Anthony. Can I just clarify the file? You mean the
SMB file, correct.
Okay, so I've heard, you know, the aspect of trademark data being dynamic, you know, mentioned a few times. And, you know, the role of the clearinghouse is to make sure that the data in there has been verified. So it sounds like, you know, one area that we could look at is, you know, what the processes are for various types of changes and seeing if those can be streamlined to make sure that the data does stay accurate. Any other comments to these?
I'm Vicky Follins from Deloitte. Well, it's the questions or the topics that are coming up here is indeed a lot of the questions that we receive also, not only when we're working with agents, but when we're working or trademark holders coming directly. It's already magical that a lot of trademark holders understand what an SMD file is, because that's one of the number one questions that we have is, what is a signed mark data file? What do we do with it? Because a lot of trademark holders that are coming to the trademark clearinghouse, they're actually a little bit of confused as to what the clearinghouse is actually the purpose of the clearinghouse, because they actually think when they record their mark with the clearinghouse that they don't have to register a domain name anymore, or that they're blocking anybody or another domain name applicant from registering their domain name as their trademark that is in the clearinghouse. So it's clear that there's a learning curve. It was there in the beginning we saw the learning curve, but unfortunately we still see that there's a lot of learning to be done, and we're very thankful that we have the agents that provide and assist in this learning education as well.
Thanks, Vicki. I can add, too, that there are a lot of questions actually find their way to ICANN as well, and a lot of the same misconceptions. You know, I thought if I put my mark in the clearinghouse that, you know, I had rights to it everywhere and nobody else would be able to get it. So it is, you know, there are a lot of permutations to the protection that, can be supported by the clearinghouse, and it is, a tough, kind of a tough educational road. But one thing I wanted to, I was going to mention at the beginning is that as we talk about reviewing the rights reduction mechanisms, you know, the kind of our, these are things that people worked really hard on for a number of years. And so our goal in reviewing and looking at them isn't to scrap things and start over. You know, we've spent a lot of time building a clearinghouse, building sunrights processes, building a URS. So what we're after is finding ways that we can build on these things. How can they be made more useful? Are there ways that you can, adjust some of the elements to address some of the things that we're seeing in early user experience? Comments on additional requests or processes that rights holders would like or that were asked for?
So a lot of trademark holders actually want to also see what trademarks are in the clearinghouse. So currently we cannot provide any information of what is actually of the data in the clearinghouse. So there are a lot of requests for that. Secondly, we have received already a lot of requests as well because the trademark clearinghouse is limited to the identical match string. And we have the fact that they can't get protection or can't get notifications for variations of their string or similar or confusing or string contained. So those are things that we've definitely have heard the community request to make it possible.
One thing that we find that comes up quite a bit is with the actual claims notices that go out. They're not identifying when it's the actual trademark holder who generated the claim. So you had mentioned those numbers earlier on the number of claims sent out. We have clients that, asked us to place orders maybe a few months ago as a different department or different person, and all of a sudden, multiple people on their end are getting a claims notice. A lot of times it's for names that they've registered themselves. So, sounds off red flags internally, and then they have to figure out, is this us or is this someone else? So to the extent that there's that can be identified a little bit easier, I think would kind of smooth the process for a lot of the rights holders.
Great. Susan?
So I suppose one of the main things like to see is kind of extending the use of the TMCH data to get sort of better value from your registration. So, for example, once you've got your mark in there and it's been validated and has proof of use, could it be used as proof of use in a UDRP as well as a URS? The SMD file should be sufficient to demonstrate that you have a mark for specification 13 if you're a brand registry applicant, because it's a verified mark and you've filed proof of use, so you shouldn't also have to then submit your trademark certificate, which is completely unnecessary. We obviously also, there were calls from the outset in the rights protection mechanisms as they were being developed for there to be some element of mark plus, so, marks plus generic terms, that kind of thing, that would obviously give greater value and certainly would be very beneficial. And some sort of, the globally protected mark list type thing, which is probably something we'll be talking about further. And then on a sort of practical note, one of the IPC members was asking for sort of instructive quarterly webinars would be very helpful, I think, to touch on the fact that for a lot of trademark owners, this is, not very clear to them what they're doing and why.
Great, thank you. Any comments from the floor on this topic? Phil?
I just had Phil Corwin for the record. I just had one question, and I apologize. It was covered at the initial presentation. I walked in the middle of that. But some may remember we had a bit of a dust-up within ICANN over the straw man proposal, and then particularly the trademark plus 50, which would allow trademark holders to not just register a mark, but register up to 50 variations of the mark if it had been recovered either through a UDR or a PO court action. I was just wondering what percentage, if any, of the registrations in the clearinghouse were not identical exact trademarks, but were confusingly similar marks won in UDRPs or court actions. If there was use of that trademark plus 50 option going on,
there's definitely use of that, but it's very, very low.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
Hi, my name is Jean-Paul Béchu. I'm the CEO and the founder of NameShield. When I created the NameShield back in 1994, was on the assumption that trademarks and domain names had to be ruled by the same IP laws. So I was very pleased when the project of TMCH came along. And we put, as a registrar, big efforts into getting things done the right way, even if we had some difficulties to know exactly what was the goals behind the ones that were in charge of TMCH. Now, after those efforts and the investments, we've got to take a look at the figures. 27,000 TMCH back in July 2014. I don't call it to be, it's not a success, and would like to know if you've got any ideas why this concept that was a good idea at the beginning is got so poor results, and what is going to be to try to change things around.
In general, it's related to the learning curve of the whole adoption of the new GTLD program.
I suppose I would say also, when the rights protection mechanisms were developed, there were a sort of suite of mechanisms which, by the time they came out of the sort of process at the end of a long development, were not the same as what had originally been proposed. And so For some rights holders, I think that there's a feeling that they that the TMCH registration doesn't get them very much for their money, and they consequently have to constantly do a cost benefit analysis on which marks they put in the TMCH and what they use them for. There are also obviously other issues around things like which registries have launched yet. I mean, the actual rollout of the registries has been probably a lot slower than everyone else was expecting. Some of the kind of more interesting, if you like, registries from the perspective of brand owners that I'm familiar with probably haven't launched yet, and so you may well, there'll be an element to which there may be more activity in future, and people wouldn't necessarily put their marks in the TMCH initially, given that you have to pay a fee and renew. You may well find that people will be putting additional marks in when they can see that they're going to be getting a value out of them.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you, Susan. I'll add to that in terms of, you know, there are some, you know, complexities in the process. There is a lot of education that's being done, and you know, it is a new concept and a new service. So I think all of those are factors, besides what Susan mentioned, that the program itself, you're seeing TLDs start to launch. Okay, Rubens, and then we'll go into sunrise periods.
Rubens, Nick.br. Isn't the difference between the number of plain notices that were displayed and the domain transactions that arise out of that a clear indication that the claims notice database was harvested by people that wanted to know which trademarks are registered to who? So isn't that an indication that the system that was designed to prevent trademark record harvesting failed?
So the answer, I think, is we don't know. You know, we have, a couple of things. You know, one, everybody who has access to, is a user of the clearinghouse has terms and conditions prescribe what can, you know, what are the uses that
that
are
would
to
apply
be made
to domain registrants, not that would apply to the trademark users, and they were harvested through attempted or personifying attempted of domain registrations. So those terms and conditions wouldn't apply to them.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you. So just to reiterate, though, you know, there are those terms and conditions in place, as well as we do continue to get reports of activity and to find out what we can about the sources of how it's happening. But
okay, thank you.
Hi, Scott Harlan from Catton, Mutz and Rosenman. Is there any update on the abused label entry and how many are those are going in? Because the last time we checked, you still had to link the registration number to the complaint, the UDRP decision, and that can be challenging sometimes when the panelists don't put the registration number that you relied on because you entered in a lot of registrations in your complaint, and they don't always put them in the panel decision. So then you would have to upload your complaint or maybe your complaint with exhibits, which makes the process very time-consuming and burdensome, depending on the client. Is there any update on that, on those numbers and that process?
So the numbers on the abused labels or the UDRP cases or court cases that have the abused or the plus 50 labels, I believe we're around 140 in total of those cases. In relation to the verification process itself, this is under discussion currently.
So thanks, Vicky. So if I can speak to Scott's question a little bit, proposal for being able to add some limited number of labels into an existing clearinghouse record, was discussed and was implemented based on, an ability to tie that court proceeding or that UDRP decision to that same mark that is in the clearinghouse that, is the same jurisdiction and can be identified as the same mark. And so what I think you're referencing, Scott, is some certain cases where the decision doesn't actually provide a clear tie to that, and as you know, that's sort of a challenge with how you can establish that in the absence of that. So I will thank you everybody for your comments there. So just to summarize what I heard about things that could be helpful or to be considered or discussed. A search feature of some sort, services beyond the exact match of the trademark, some means of reducing confusion about the claims notices by indicating who the initiator of the record was. Whether SMD files can be used for other purposes. I think that's what I wrote down. So let's go on to sunrise periods. There are a few topics that we're discussing here in our review, so I'll ask Antonita to run through those quickly.
So our report will also review the sunrise period, which was developed to allow rights holders with an advance opportunity to register names prior to corresponding their mark prior to them being made available to the general public. We will look at sunrise statistics, such as sunrise registrations, which new utilities have the most sunrise registrations. Our review will also look at the limited registration period, which was developed to allow additional flexibilities for registries who may wish to make names available for registration to particular entities who do not own a trademark in that name prior to them being made available to the public. We will also review the approved launch program where registries would be allowed to conduct a registration process if approved by ICANN, as well as a qualified launch program, which allows currently registries who apply to use a limited number of names in connection with the registry launch activities while meeting the RPM requirements. We will also look at the Sunrise dispute resolution policy, which was developed to allow disputes to Sunrise registrations. And our review will also touch on the topic of reserved names. We received a number of inquiries from registries requesting further clarification on the process of releasing reserved names.
Thank you, Antonietta. So I've put a number of questions up here relating to the Sunrise period. From a few different angles. So for those rights holders who were, or those working with rights holders in helping process domain registrations during Sunrise, what was that experience? What factors were taken into account in deciding among all of the TLDs, which you're going to pursue Sunrise registrations? There are a number of places you can go out there to find out, you know, who's launching when and what the rules are, so we're interested in, what information sources were the most useful in that. From the registry standpoint, in terms of operating Sunrise periods, questions posed are what, patterns or results did you observe during the Sunrise period, and what the experience of the dispute resolution policy during Sunrise was. And also expect that registrars fielded a number of questions regarding the Sunrise registration process. So interested in any responses to that from the panel or from the floor. Anthony?
The most difficult things that we've seen for rights holders as far as Sunrise after they get their mark in the clearinghouse is, the whole issue of reserved and name collision names. Some registries are taking applications into Sunrise for name collision names, for example, pending them dropping off the list. A lot of others aren't. And clients, for example, we have a client that has 237 names on collision lists across, all the various TLDs. And so for them, a lot of these names they, of course, are interested in, but they really have no guidance, and we really have no, dates or processes to kind of go over with them at this point. And I think a lot of the questions that, what's the rollout going to be on names coming off collision lists, and what rights are rights holders going to have to get those names, to protect their rights is one of the bigger issues that we're looking at right now.
Susan?
Adding on, I suppose, to the reserve name you just mentioned, one of the concerns that the IP community has had about reserve names is that there is the scope for using them to circumvent the Sunrise. There are no limits on the number of names that can be reserved by a registry, and if they reserve them and keep them reserved for the duration of the Sunrise, they can release them afterwards without putting them through a Sunrise period. So that has been a major concern and is something that we would like to see tightened up. Related to that is the issue of terms being called premium names. A lot of registries are identifying particular terms which they consider to be premium and then charging high fees for them or higher than the average fee for them. In some cases, that may seem perfectly reasonable, and some sort of generic terms are probably high value. But if the premium is too high, it becomes effectively a means of circumventing the Sunrise, and particularly if it is a trademark term that has been selected to be a premium name. This is definitely the case in some cases. In fact, some premium name lists are generated by means of sort of looking at things like search terms, which are used in conjunction with the term which is covered by the TLD, so that it inevitably finds trademark terms. And then, you know, brand owners are being expected to pay an extortionately high fee to get that name in the Sunrise. I think I said there's no limit again on the number of premium names that registries can identify. And there's not always clarity on what they've put on their list. Sometimes they're in their Sunrise and they say they haven't actually decided yet what their premium name list is, but when the trademark owner tries to register the Sunrise term, they're then told that the mark is a premium one. And we're aware of one GOTLD, for example, that's got 63,000 premium names on it, including every 3- and 4- character word in the Oxford English Dictionary. So there is abuse there, potential for abuse.
Dan?
I finally feel like I can say something now. So I'm with Rightside. Rightside is an end-to-end domain name services company, so we're a registry and a registrar. So I'll give you a few data points on some of these in answer to some of these questions, but I'm only giving you a snapshot data point of what's happening at my registry, and that's not to be interpreted as being, you know, a trend across all registries, because I think it really depends upon which top-level domain name you're launching, and that can affect the data around Sunrise, as I'll explain. So one of your questions was, what patterns did you observe during the Sunrise period? Well, we had a relatively quiet Sunrise period. We had 2,359 Sunrise applications for 26 strings we've launched. So that's relatively quiet in terms of Sunrise activity. I think you showed, Karen, a data point that said per TLD was about 118. So we're a bit under 100 Sunrise applications per TLD. But we did see some spikes in Sunrise applications depending upon which string we had launched. So, for example, we are the top-level TLD operator for .reviews. And so you can imagine if you're a product company that puts out a product and, you know, you might want to get your reviews top-level domain name to protect your trademark in that product, in that namespace. So we saw a lot of, you know, Sunrise activity for that. A little less so for other TLDs that we had. And then I also see a question there about how often was the SDRP used to resolve the disputes. We did not get any SDRP disputes in the 2,300 Sunrise applications. We didn't see a single SDRP dispute.
Thank you. Anyone else? Anyone else out here have a comment, a question?
Wunderstaff from CORE. We work for a number of community-based TLD, and you know, we're talking about the abuse that was just mentioned by registries who put domain names in the reserved list and in order to get them for themselves and sell them as premiums. We've seen probably worse in the inverse abuse. Well, the trademark clearinghouse being open to abuse, you know, people registering in the trademark clearinghouse a string that is a generic word. They just use a pictorial trademark, and there's a string in there, so you can put it in. And very much in the very business for which they want it, you know. So basically somebody says, my trademark is plumber, I'm a plumber. No, of course, that is not supposed to be the purpose of the trademark clearinghouse. And we have been lucky up to now not to have too many of them, and I know why. The reason why we had not too many of them is the bad performance of the entire concept of the trademark clearinghouse as a whole. So if we clean up the problems of the trademark clearinghouse, make it actually a little bit more effective, maybe less expensive and so on, less difficult, then of course that problem would increase. And so we certainly have a good reason to address that, and at least empower the registries to make sure that this is not going to be abused.
Thank you, Werner. Can I ask a follow-up question to your comment? So you know, you spoke of abuse of the clearinghouse, and you know it will help to clean things up. Can you maybe a little more concretely, like what exactly type of abuse
Is a result of a systemic weakness in the concept of the trademark clearinghouse. The trademark clearinghouse only looks at the second level domain. Now, the second level domain, depending on what we talk about, has a different meaning. So if you have a trademark, in this case, it wasn't used abusively, but it could have been. If it take a word that everybody knows, this Metro. Now, Metro is a brand. There's nothing wrong with a brand like Metro. You have the right. But if you then say, I would like to use this to get Metro.Paris, of course it would not be acceptable. Because that brand has nothing to do with the Metro of Paris. Maybe they're selling newspapers or whatever. In this case, these people haven't done that, but there would be a danger of that that happening. The other one, I don't know them by heart. Those are cases where products, like generic names for products, were used as a brand. Maybe, you know, for some reason what it got through in the country, maybe I'm not sure, but it went through in the trademark clearinghouse as a brand, as if it was not a generic term. So the example that I said, you know, I'm a plumber and my brand is plumber, that is precisely the thing that is not supposed to be possible on the trademark law. So we have a situation where a trademark clearinghouse is open to use in a way that is inconsistent with trademark law. Actually violates it in that way. I take an advantage that I'm precisely not supposed to have, according to trademark law. That is actually the same, all the trademark law in all the countries. If I'm a plumber, I cannot say that my trademark is plumber.
Thank you, Renner, for clarifying. So I guess I'll speak a little bit to one of the things you mentioned, although it was it's kind of around the clearinghouse guidelines and verification process more than the Sunrise. And that is that, you know, that there's a, you know, one of the really difficult aspects of implementing a, global database that accepts marks from every jurisdiction is to establish how to do that. And that was, debated at length, with a few different permutations of, you know, this is how it could work, this is how it could work, this is how it could work. And, you know, most of the, a lot of the issues that people raise around, you know, why is this in the clearinghouse or why is that in the clearinghouse, kind of go back to how you fit and how you address the very, different standards and processes for how trademarks are issued around the world. So I think that's will continue to be an area of discussion. And I also wanted to mention as well that, you know, there is a dispute mechanism with the clearinghouse, so there is always the opportunity to challenge the inclusion of a mark or the rejection of a mark from the clearinghouse through the delay process. Anything else on Sunrise? Oh, Susan.
I was just going to mention a few of the sort of more practical issues that some brand owners have encountered. One in particular is that there has been some difficulty in finding out which registrars are accredited for particular registries in some situations, so that it can then be difficult to get a Sunrise application filed. And one of the suggestions we had was that it would be, in fact, really helpful if registries would publish lists of their accredited registrars on their website so that they could be located. We also, a number of people have encountered quite sort of fairly unhelpful responses back from registrars where they've been trying to get a particular name of just sort of the domain name is not available. And it generally isn't making it clear if that's because the registrar isn't actually handling that TLD, or if it's a name collision name, or if it's a reserve name that the registry has reserved, or it's gone, you know. So there could be more clarity from registrars on exactly what the problem is if a name isn't available. We've also had a few issues with sort of when conflicting mark situations occur where two or more trademark owners have perfectly legitimately the same mark in the trademark clearinghouse and are therefore coming up against each other. And auctions are often being used as the sort of allocation method in those kind of conflict situations. But in some situations with very short notice of the auction being given, even as short as 48 hours, which just is not long enough for people to deal with. And also, it's... It, it would be very helpful, and I realise that there are difficulties around releasing information about other applicants, but it would, in fact, be very helpful to try to resolve conflict situations to be able to know who else it is that you is seeking to register the domain, because, you know, you're forced into an auction situation when, in fact, you might have been able to just negotiate some kind of, you know, sensible compromise. So those are some of the practical things. And I should have probably mentioned earlier that for some registries, there's been incomplete information about their sunrises. The TLD startup page is incomplete or has sort of false or out-of-date information. I think, you know, because things move quite quickly, but so maybe the sunrise policy isn't there, or it's referring to some other document like a registration policy, which isn't there. And then I suppose you did also ask what factors get taken into account in choosing whether to pursue. So I could move on to that one since before we move on, I guess, which is, I mean, it's the basic kind of cost-benefit analysis, the kind of looking at things like the industry relevance of the string, whether there's any kind of sensitive issues, so that if it's a sort of string that might be associated with the adult industry and you're a children's brand, you would probably be looking to do a defensive registration in those kind of situations, the likelihood of infringement generally, and the price, and also whether there's any sort of other block being offered. So the donuts DPML, for example, you might well be utilising that and not actually utilising a sunrise registration.
All right, thank you. Can
I say something?
Sure, of course.
Going to Susan's point on, you know, when a potential registrant is searching for a domain name and it comes back as unavailable. As a registrar and, you know, working a lot on the implementation side of things and with registries, it's probably that we find is it's an extremely difficult thing to implement. Not all registries are created equally. Their policies and definitions of terms, you know, are not all the same. And as far as releasing premium lists and reserve lists, there's no policy for when those need to be done except before GA. So as a registrar, you know, we could get that the day before. And in the meantime, we've lost out and registrants have lost out because they've already been searching for a lot of these names. They're unavailable. They're not going to come back. So my fear is that we have a lot of, you know, legitimate consumers out there, you know, getting discouraged because when all the noise is being made before a launch, which a registry typically does, if they're not ready with those things, you know, everything shows as unavailable. And you don't typically get that user back for a long time, if at all. So, you know, some little more focus on uniform standards and rolling out, you know, the logistics of some of these launches would, you know, make that process smoother for everyone.
Yep, I think that's a great point. Along with, you want to add something? Yeah.
I wanted to make one more point, actually, about we're not generally, I mean, most registries are not sort of bad actors, but there have been some examples of genuinely bad actors in the space in terms of trying not to run the sunrise by practical means of not signing up registrars. And whilst that's obviously a matter for the registrars, it's actually also a matter for the brand owners, because if there's no registrars, then you can't buy sunrise names. And there are some specific registries who have done that.
Rubens.
Rubens Q, for the record. I have a question for every registrar that wishes to comment on, and that I noticed that many registrars opted out of offering sunrise registrations or offering claims registration. So is the process difficult, or how many registrars do you figure out having are not selling either sunrise or claim registrations?
You know, it's a very difficult thing to implement. And if you look at, you know, all the accredited registrars out there, a lot of them are, you know, a lot smaller registrars without the bandwidth, you know, to implement these things. If you notice, for example, premium names, you see a lot of registrars are not selling premium names because you have, you know, price checks and dynamic pricing that you've got to implement. And I think with the numbers that we've seen in the program overall, a lot of registrars are making the decision not to move forward with that at this point.
Thank you. There was quite a range of input there. So, you know, I heard, you know, in particular some, you know, details of coordination, you know, how do you know which registrars are, you know, accredited for this TLD? How do you know what's on the reserve list and on the premium names list? We actually have seen, you know, gotten a number of complaints too, where the registrar is saying this is not available, where it is available. It's just they're not selling names during that particular period. So we've addressed that. I guess one other point that I wanted to add is that, you know, we do want to know when people are identifying what they believe are issues. You mentioned, Susan, that there's registries that aren't signing up registrars, or, you know, cases like that. I mean, we do have you know, a number of issues raised through different channels, through customer service, through compliance. And so, and this is, you know, to everyone, I would encourage you that if you have, you know, concern or issue around a particular, you know, element or behavior, that you do let us know about that. Okay. Trademark Claims Service is what follows the sunrise period. So we're looking at a few things here. And I'll ask Antonietta to talk about this briefly.
Thank you. So we're also going to be reviewing the trademark claims, which is another service that's mandated for all new GTLDs and was sort of developed to strengthen trademark protection by providing notices to those rights holders with matching records in the clearinghouse when someone has registered a domain name matching a mark that is recorded in the clearinghouse. We will review how effective it was by looking at statistical claims data, such as number of claim registrations that occurred during the claims period, number of claim notices generated, which new GTLDs had the most registrations during the claims period. We will also be looking at the UDRP plus 50, which is an add-on to the claims service, and its intention was was developed as a protective measure to guard against trademark abuse, as well as the ongoing notification service, which is provided by the clearinghouse to the rights holders to inform them when someone has registered a name that's matching a mark in the clearinghouse, as well as the extended claims service provided by registries for a definite or indefinite amount of time to inform both the rights holders and the registrant when someone has registered a domain name matching a mark that is in the clearinghouse.
Thank you, Antonietta. So we want to know here, how is the trademark claims service working? There are actually two steps to the claims process. One is that a potential registrant gets this notice displayed, so we're interested in what type of perceptions or reactions have there been, and if there's anyone here who's received one of those and wants to comment, please do. And then that also, once the registration proceeds, results in a notification back to the rights holder who has a matching mark in the clearinghouse. And the goal with that was that, you know, they would know right away when that name was registered and could decide if they wanted to take any additional steps. So we're interested in, you know, how that notice worked. Could any of these processes be improved, and could any of the notices be tweaked? So any input on that? Susan?
Yeah, why not? Okay, so I mean, from the perspective of the rights holders, I think I'm sure the registrar can comment on the reaction of receiving the notices. I mean, I think generally those who are informed found that it was generally working well, insofar as it, you know, it has some limitations in the process, in the sense that you get a notification after the event. But, you know, you get a notification, you then have an opportunity to go on the site, see whether it's being used, and take a view on whether you're going to take any further action. So in that sense, it is working fine. Obviously, it would be, from a rights holder perspective, it would be a more useful service if you got some kind of advance notice of the prior to the registration, rather than only the opportunity to take retrospective action after the registration has already been made. But Yes, and insofar as it does what it's supposed to, it is working relatively well. There is a feeling that it would be useful to have a way of capturing historic information that could be retained by the TMCH, so that even if it was for just a year or so to go back, so that you could go back and search and see all the notices against a particular client or a particular mark, which would help with tracking and identifying trends of bad actors.
You know, I think it's early to really make a determination on how effective it's been. You see, I think we're about 2.6 million registrations overall in the new GTLD program, 145 URS filings. I'm not sure how many UDRP have been filed around new GTLDs, but it's hard to say whether, you know, we have brand holders registering names and we have a lot of people with close ties to the domain name community itself, and we haven't gone out into the mass market yet. For the most part. So I think that's when that occurs, we'll start seeing this be more effective. You know, the message is clear in the checkout process. If you're purchasing on a registrar website, it's pretty clear on, you know, what you're looking at. And by judging by the number of disputes, I think at this point it's working fairly well for what it was intended.
Thanks. Vicki?
What we receive sometimes the questions on the claim service is that trademark holders don't always know what they need to do once they receive this notification. Those that work with agents, of course, the agents assist them, but it might be a good idea indeed to at least give them the option in the notice saying you can go to URS or your DRP or get legal assistance or whatever for whatever purpose. So that's something that might be. And another thing that we also has received a comment is the fact that you only get the notices for after you record. So you record your mark in the clearinghouse, but the notice is only effective after everything is done, and you don't know what happened in the past. So a question that we also receive is, would it be possible to actually receive NORNs of registered names that happened before I actually entered my mark in the clearinghouse?
Okay, thank you. Any other comments on this? Yes.
Hi, Jody Culker. Excuse me. One of the claims that we have is that when you try to register a domain name, you have to accept the claim 48 hours before the registration is done. So it's a rolling 48-hour window that happens. As you know, most of the registrars will take pre-registrations for domains for general availability. That requires that once we take a pre-registration, we have to have the customer come back and accept that pre-registration 48 hours beforehand. That's a very tight window, as I've heard the IP community say, they only have 48 hours before an auction starts. Well, it's also the same for a registrant. I'm wondering if there is some way that we can increase that time from 48 hours to a week to maybe indefinitely if a claim is not put on that debate from the time that the acceptance is made. So, for instance, if someone comes in and purchases a domain a month before it's actually registered or can be registered, and no claim has been, additional claim has been made, or a claim hasn't been updated, whether that acceptance from a month ago could be used to register that domain.
Hi, Karen Malinchari-Evil from Mark Monitor. This is Lily. She's here in her personal capacity.
But, excellent.
I just have a comment on claims notification as it relates to domain names that were registered in a pre-registration period from registrars. We did notice through a couple of examples with our clients that the claims notifications came from the registrar and were in some cases improperly worded, and that then the registrant did not actually receive the claims notification themselves because the domain name was registered on their behalf by the registrar. So I'm assuming the registrar got the claims notification that was meant for the registrant. So in the future and in next rounds, we want to make sure that the claims notifications are properly worded and that they're delivered to the registrant because, of course, proper notice to these individuals is imperative in enforcement. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And I'll reiterate, you know, in relation to the wording of the notice, there is a required notice. So, you know, please notify us of instances where that's not happening. Werner.
Werner Staub. I would like to echo what was just said about the claims window, because it is extremely tight. And actually, if you look at it more closely, it is not that important. You know, who cares if this was 24 hours before, a week before, a month before, or possibly even a month after? You know, it's not really so important. What we learned in the actual use of the trademark clearinghouse, that it was much more important for the trademark holder to be informed about it. That was very important. So in terms of the claims notices, it might just be sent by email to the registrant email, because, of course, they're obliged to have that email. So that's an obligation. If they don't listen on that email, well, you know, that's as good as delivered. You know, that's would be crazy to say, no, sorry, I didn't receive it on the address that I specified as the one on which I'm reachable. So it is useless. However, what is very useful is that notice. But however, you know, the note is not going to stay unless we do something about the trademark clearinghouse. And my view would be that registries should actually continue to send a feed to the trademark clearinghouse, so that the parties that need to be informed about somebody, you know, using their string could actually react. It is really a great comfort for them.
Thanks, Werner. John Berryhill?
Following on to what Kiran said, John Berryhill, there is another gap in notice. I mean, if the point of the trademark claims, you know, service was to remove a defense of ignorance from the various dispute proceedings, is a lot of the initial domain names that are registered as new TLDs launched are registered on a speculative basis. And someone may have, you know, gotten the claims notice, says, okay, you know, there are the goods and services that I can't use it for, check, use it for something else. But that name may be transferred very, very quickly, very soon to, you know, to another registrant, particularly if these are reserved by entities that are then auctioning them off. So you could have a domain name registered within the first week of launch where that first registrant gets the trademark claims notice, but there's no obligation of, you know, passing that notice along to successive registrants who may get the domain name. So you end up with a lot of people 2-3 weeks after launch who got, you know, who now have the domain names and never even saw a trademark claims notice or knew one existed. So that's something to think about, looking at registration changes before the expiration of the claims notice period.
Thanks, John. We have a remote comment or question?
Yes, there's a comment from the remote from Michael Fleming. He said, it would be a great help to allow a bi-mark email setup so that we can set up the email that we want the claims notification to go to. In the event of a trademark agent, it is important that while the trademark agent receives the trademark notification and has the responsibility to pass this to the trademark owner, to also have a dual claim sent to the trademark owner as well.
Okay, noted. Thank you. Can I say
one thing?
Yes, Anthony.
The issue that John had brought up, a lot of the problem is that the agents are the ones responsible for, you know, making sure a rights holder gets the notice. So, you know, they've signed their agreements. They know what they're supposed to do. Whether that's happening all the time is really difficult to say. I talked to Vicky a little bit about it. Being able to specify an additional email address that notices can be sent to, and, you know, having the clearinghouse kind of have a little more control over that process.
Yes.
Bill Stoll, Core Search. Has anybody had any actual experience with a dispute being, you know, settled where really it's obviously, I mean, it's early days yet, but where really the arbitrator looks and says, "Oh, you accepted the claim. You're on your back foot." I mean, in theory, I can see that, but any real experience? Yeah. Okay. You asked related questions. I thought you might.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I've defended three URSs, and in every URS complaint, if anyone, you know, wants some tips on writing URS complaints, one allegation that really doesn't work well is, oh, and he registered it despite a trademark claims notice. You know, well, it goes without saying that you know, had there been a mechanism intended to prevent these registrations, then there would be one. The whole point of the notice is that, yes, there was notice. That's the trademark. Those are the goods or services. And we're using the domain name for, you know, some dictionary or generic purpose associated with that term. But, you know, so in answer to the question, it is strenuously alleged in just about every URS filing, but, you know, isn't a really impressive allegation, you know, other than the fact that, yeah, not only, you know, the people that I was representing, not only do they have the trademark claims notice, but they keep them in a database so that if they, you know, someone contacts them about the domain name or acquiring it, they can pass that on and say, you know, oh, and by the way, you know, there's this trademark claim here, so, you know, just so you're aware of it. But it's not a very impressive allegation, you know, the way it plays out, depending upon what the facts.
Thank you, John. Yes, and it will be interesting to see if there are any cases where that is a factor. So we have 5 minutes left. So what I'm going to do is kind of flash through the rest of the questions and ask for feedback on any and all of them. The last set was about the URS. Any experiences using it? Is it quick and expensive as intended? Is it appropriately balanced? And what factors might make it more effective? As well as sort of some overall questions about any data points or statistics that you think would be pretty significant to help us assess the impact of these RPMs. And sort of qualitatively, what do you consider the most important elements to address in the RPM reviews? So a few minutes left. Anyone want to tackle any of those? Susan?
I'll be really quick, and I'll just do the sort of headline response on the URS, which is that most people haven't been using it. A few people have, and they've had reasonably okay experience. The vast majority have not used it, and the reasoning behind that is that essentially the remedy is inadequate and it's not a good enough value for money. Even though it's cheaper than UDRP, you don't get the domain name back, and having it simply suspended with the risk that it goes back into the general pool and you go into a cycle of having to do this is just not attractive to anyone. So if it's a name that is causing enough concern that someone wants to spend money and try and get it back, then they're either doing a UDRP or legal action or something. They're not generally doing a URS because just having the name suspended is not of sufficient value.
Staten Hammock again. An interesting data point, again, from our perspective, is we have 95,000 registrations in our new GTLDs. We've had only 11 URS claims as a result and zero UDRPs. So I don't know if that's a counter data point to what you just said, Sarah, but zero UDRPs, 11 URSs for those registrations we've had.
Okay, thanks. Any other comments? John?
I'll just share one practice tip for people that are doing URS complaints, because I saw this come up habitually in the ones that I was defending, is that under the first element of the URS, you can either show a trademark registration and show how you use the trademark, or you can provide an SMD from the Trademark Clearinghouse as, you know, conclusive proof on that point. The problem is that if you do that, and remembering that you're only limited to 500 words, the panelists cannot actually decode that SMD. They just say, oh, well, there it's there, so this point is proven, but they don't know necessarily even what the goods or services are, you know, in the trademark. So, like, you know, one of the cases I defended and won, which, I mean, the result was correct anyway, but I felt badly for the complainant because, you know, one of the arguments I was able to make was, you know, who knows if this trade, if this domain name's infringing, we don't even know what the goods or services are. So if you're using the URS and you want to rely on, you know, the SMD certificate from the Trademark Clearinghouse, also include a trademark certification and a listing of your goods and services, you know, somewhere in that first element, because you could just blow the whole case right there.
I think that's in the SMD, though, too, isn't it?
But the SMD file goes to the panelists, right?
Right.
I mean, it's just, you know, it's just some dude, you know, who doesn't have any way to actually decode the SMD, you know.
Okay.
or some dudette, excuse me.
All right. So thank you, everybody. I have two things that I wanted to mention before we close and get to the next session. So one is for the couple of people who mentioned the 48-hour window and some issue with that. I'm not the technical person, but I think that may be a little bit of a misunderstanding. So we do have some technical people from IBM up here. So I encourage you to talk to them, or please, you can also contact us through the portal or through customer service for we can maybe clarify that for you. Second thing is just to thank all of our great panelists for all of their input. Thank you to all of you for your thoughtful comments, and you've given us a lot to think about, and we will keep working. Thanks a lot. Bye.
I think I'm a little bit, but I can actually make it.